You're listening to Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Think of home in Los Angeles, and what comes to your mind? Well, very likely the single-family home, you know, the one with the big backyard. Of course, that's not the full picture. While two-thirds of residential land is zoned for single-family homes or very low-rise, the reality is that more than half of LA's dwellings are some form of multi-family dwellings. And as new building gets denser and denser, the price of real estate climbs and climbs, Angelenos will more and more be living in some kind of multi-family housing, as you can see from all the construction around town. KCRW's longtime architecture contributor Frances Anderton has written a book called Common Ground, Multifamily Housing in Los Angeles, and she's taking us on a tour to talk about it today. Hi, Frances.
Hello, Steve.
So nice to see you here. And we are at 3rd Street. We're just a couple of blocks to the west of Lincoln Boulevard, a couple of blocks south of Santa Monica. We're close to the beach in Venice. Huge succulents and sycamore trees and jacarandas and plum trees lining the sidewalk. And there's a tall black fence. So you brought us here to see what's behind this fence.
That's right, Steve. The theme of the book that I have worked on is that amidst the hundreds of thousands of multifamily buildings in Los Angeles exist a particular type of housing which is very much oriented to creating a sense of community.
It's common ground.
That's the common ground. It starts back over 100 years ago. You may be familiar with very adorable bungalow courts. We're going to be going to see something called a garden apartment complex. These are building types where the emphasis is on creating a sense of shared place and space. I'm taking you now to what I consider to be an absolute little paradise.
Well, we're at a gate right now.
We're at a gate.
We're closed off, Frances.
We're behind a gate. In fact, we are on a three-lot property owned by a couple, Thomas Fuller and William Kelly. They bought one lot, built a house on it. They bought the next two lots, which had already cottages on those lots. They maintained those cottages and they brought in landscape designers, very good ones, who then turned the entire estate, if you will, into a large shared garden with some cottages on it.
So shall we?
Yes, go ahead.
Hey.
Hi.
Steve.
Hi.
Nice to meet
I'm
you.
Bill.
Love you.
Nice to meet
Hello,
you. Francis. Very
welcome.
Nice.
Well, come on in. Come on in.
This is so lovely.
Yeah, I promise you, Steve, this is like a mini paradise. And it is to Tom and Bill's credit that they actually themselves created this.
Bill, tell us about it.
We looked at houses up in Malibu, Santa Monica Canyon, north of Montana in Santa Monica, and everything was separated from the city. This is a more urban, you could walk. It was a little different then, but it was still, you know, it was nice.
Yeah.
And then I realized, yeah, why would I want to live in some big house up in, say, Santa Monica Canyon or up in Malibu, and you're going to commute 45 minutes to get to work. Everything's a car, and you're alone. If you get done with work, you go home at the end of the day, and you're home, and you're alone. Then as we bought the properties, you know, you could tear everything down and just have everything to yourself, but I actually realized I'd like the neighbors. And we had little get-togethers, socially distanced, cocktail parties during the pandemic. It was great.
And what we've done is we've created little rooms. So there's 9 units here plus our house, 15 people, I think 10 or 12 dogs, and 4 cats sharing the space.
You have a population count.
We do, yes. And but we've created little rooms, so we're not on top of each other. Everyone can get together in the great lawn, or we can have little dining. There's 2 dining rooms. There's a little sitting room down here we walk past. So everyone has their space as well if they need some, you know, privacy time.
As I said, you can go buy a big, huge mansion and live inside your 20 rooms, but the best part of the city is just being out here. This is the part I just love. Just to be out in the garden and having people and friends, it's great.
But this is unique. Multifamily dwellings, one property that sort of was sewn together. Now we're going to another place where it's just a large, sprawling community that was built many, many years ago and has this common space.
And it's called Lincoln Place.
Thank you. All right, a little farther south now from where we were at Rose and Third, and we're at Lincoln Place, which is on the border of Santa Monica and Venice. And this is a very large, sprawled-out apartment complex, right?
Absolutely. 38 acres in total is the scale of it, and hundreds of buildings. This is a really fantastic example of what is known as a garden apartment complex. These were a type of development that appeared in the New Deal years, in the 40s and 50s. They were built to house working class people. They were built on what were known as super blocks. You basically took a whole bunch of blocks and you combined them into one. You put the road to the edge as much as you could. You then built within that, collections of apartments in little courtyards connected to open space. The idea was one of giving working families well-lit, naturally lit apartments, access to the open, views onto this shared open space where children could play safely. They were channeling ideas of the time, very idealistic ideas about how working people could live. This place has gone through changes over time. It went through a great big fight about a decade ago because the place is beloved. It is beloved by its residents. And I would argue it is beloved because of the orientation towards community. Let's bring in Dennis Hathaway. He lives right by Lincoln Place, and he has written a book just published called The Battle of Lincoln Place. So, Dennis, great to see you here. Tell us, in your view, how the design impacted the fight to save Lincoln Place.
Well, I think it had a whole lot to do with it. And when I first started researching for this book, started interviewing people, it became very clear to me that this place was designed, it was conceptually and functionally a community. It wasn't just a collection of apartment houses. And they would say that this is the first place I ever lived, or the only place I ever lived, where it felt like a real community. I knew my neighbors. I met my neighbors. I didn't just walk out the door and get in my car and go to work. I would see people. It was a definite community. And I think that fact, the fact that the tenants association were able to organize and to fight the landlord, the plan to tear the whole place down and successfully defeat that plan, had everything to do with the design as a community. It enabled people to come together and people to work together for a common purpose.
And in fact, we have two people who can attest to that right now. I'm going to introduce to you Ingrid Muller, who is a longtime resident of Lincoln Place, very much involved in the fight to save it.
Hi, I'm Ingrid. I was enchanted when I moved in as an empty nester. It was quiet. It had open space. It had all the trees. Now I know it's over 350 mature trees here. It almost looks like a park. Families went about their working lives. It's just the layout. It's the meandering streets and walkways and back alleys that invite, communication.
Francis, why don't we build apartment complexes like this anymore in LA? And it's obviously a space issue.
Yeah, the ratio of buildings to land is obviously so favorable towards the greenery. And I think many designers would love to build places like this. I will say that there are contemporary architects who are trying to do, to the extent possible, some kind of homage to this, some kind of variant.
And that's what we're going to go see next.
And that's what we're going to go and see next.
Well, let's go. Let's stream across this beautiful grass, shall we? So here we are, just a few blocks north of where we were at Lincoln Place, and this is Rose Avenue.
And the building is called Rose Apartments, and we're standing right actually by Whole Foods Market, which is opposite the building, and we're looking at what I think you'd probably agree with me, Steve, is a rather impressive looking facade. You might not tell from looking at this building that this is some 40 units or so built for 50% formerly unhoused people and 50% TAYA, that is young people who are transitioning out of foster care into adulthood. This is a building that was built built by Venice Community Housing Corporation. It is what's known as affordable housing. It's non-profit development. And what I argue in the book is that there has been a movement within Los Angeles to build some really effective affordable housing by a cluster of non-profit housing developers who work with extremely talented architects like Angie Brooks, who is standing right beside me. And here what they have done is they have continued this theme that I've already talked to you about, Steve, which is designing places in a way that enable community. So you have your 38 units in three wings, connected wings, around a central shared space, a courtyard, if you will.
Yes, this is a very dense building, and I would love to see Rose Avenue with several buildings of this type. You know, I think this is what we need, our urban space in this city. And people who have been homeless through trauma need a place like this where they can be secure and feel protected, but also feel like they're open to the street. And so it was a very strategic move to put the courtyard on the second level, because this is a very, very secure building, but it's not a building that looks like it has a fence around it. It doesn't look defensive. It's a very good neighbor to the rest of the community. And that's what we really tried to do. We tried to make a sculptural piece, but also a great place for the people who live here. You can kind of see the green planting that's everywhere that's growing in. You know, we know that when you actually see something green, you feel closer to it and you feel more connected to it. And so this is a green space that the neighborhood can share in as well.
So Steve, I'll just say that there is a great tradition in Los Angeles of low-rise, courtyard-based buildings. You might have heard of the bungalow court. We then went to the garden apartment. As LA gets denser, as we build higher, it gets harder and harder to find the space to enable people to walk just straight out onto a piece of land. So what you're seeing now is really imaginative ways of bringing the garden up. So Rose Apartments, as you see, has this raised courtyard area, but it's not dry. They've put in really lovely landscaping that the residents and the neighborhood get to enjoy. Is that fair to say, Angie?
Well, before air conditioning, we used to build buildings with courtyards, and they were called alphabet buildings. Even very tall buildings were built this way, narrow floor plates and courtyards. And so we want to do that because we want to build passive buildings that don't require a lot of energy. And that's just a really simple way to make a beautiful building that doesn't use as much energy as a typical building that doesn't have a courtyard.
And you get the community. You get the community, yep. Which is the bonus. And it's something that Francis is talking about, and we've had so many examples today. Francis Anderton, the book is called Common Ground, Multifamily Housing in Los Angeles on Angel City Press. You can find it on their website, or you can find it at our website, kcrw.com/GLA, or at your local bookstore. Francis and Angie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, straight ahead on GLA, there's a lot of community in baseball. How one person in the Dodgers family has branched out while playing a super supportive role. That's coming up after this short break.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiotakis. The LA Dodgers, with their best record in baseball, slide into the playoffs tonight with a division series against one of their National League West rivals, the San Diego Padres. All the usuals will be there, Mookie, Cody, Freddie, and of course, one of the most beloved Dodgers himself, third baseman Justin Turner. Now, if there's a home run derby for enthusiasm, JT hits one across the center field wall more times than you can count, and that zeal runs in the family. His wife, Courtney, has a few things to say on social media and her own podcast. She talks about the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat, even recently talking about singing the national anthem.
The night before I sang, I sat and watched the top 20 worst anthem performances of all time, from people that fell on the ice at hockey games to Fergie's.
The guy that was skating around and he tripped on the carpet?
No, but I've seen that one. No, the girl at the hockey game that walks out, starts singing, forgets the words, says, "I'm so sorry," and then goes to turn around and leave and then falls on her ass.
Just a snippet from Holding Court that she hosts with her husband. Courtney, welcome to Greater LA.
Thank you for having me. It's a very exciting day in the Turner household, so I'm ready for it.
It sure is. It sure is. How are the Dodgers looking, do you think, facing off against the Padres tonight?
Well, in my professional opinion, they're feeling good. You know, I asked Justin every day. They've been having their kind of workouts and little sim games. I'm like, how are the vibes? Are the vibes good? He's like, oh, yeah, we're not worried. We're relaxed, we're confident, and it's just such an incredible group this year, and he can't say that enough. So I always go off of his vibe, so I think they're feeling pretty good.
I mean, the bigger rivalry is with the Giants, obviously, in San Francisco, but the Padres always somehow play spoiler, kind of like that gnat that you have to like swat away, right? I hate to characterize it that way because they have hopes and dreams too, but you know,
I'm going to go off 2020, and I feel like that's kind of what we're going to lean into for that. I did hear that they're not selling tickets to Dodger fans in San Diego, which I found kind of interesting. So they might be a little worried about a blue takeover.
Some teams do
down
that.
South.
Yeah. When it's only a couple of hours away, you know, you get a lot of blue. Which is what happened, by the way, last weekend at SoFi Stadium with the Rams, right? That's what a lot of Cowboy fans showed up at SoFi Stadium. But anyway, what is it exactly about the thrill of baseball that draws you in?
I mean, my anxiety? No, I don't know. It's such a, I think for people that are not in it and are not really a baseball fan, they can kind of, I don't know, they say the sport's boring, but I think the more you learn about it, you realize all the different components and it just draws you in. I think, I don't know, there's something about it when someone gets that big hit or that big out to, you know, escape a jam at the end of an inning. It just, you really can't explain it. And I can already just picture Dodger Stadium tonight and everyone just losing their mind over a big hit or a big strikeout. It's really hard to describe, truly. I don't know what it is, but the nerves will be there and just kind of, I always just say nerves and anxiety is just another word for excitement. So just kind of trying to channel that tonight to stay pretty calm, but yeah.
Do you travel with the team, by the way? Do you go from place to place with Justin?
Yeah, we don't travel with the team, but I'll go there. I actually just hit all 30 stadiums this year, so that was a big accomplishment for me, but I try to go to most of them. I think, you know, you never know how long their career is going to be, so I like to be a part of it. I enjoy it. I won't say that I am forever frustrated about packing and unpacking a suitcase and getting to the airport and all of those things, but I think you just have to enjoy it while it's here, and I love going to games. I know a lot of the wives, they don't love baseball probably as much as I do, but I actually fully enjoy it. So that's one of the best parts of my life.
You just said the wives, right? And I want to get to that. What does that make you feel when, like, you're a wife of a baseball player? Is that a negative moniker, do you think? Is there a connotation to that, or do you just go with that?
Totally. I think for me, it's hard because, you know, as someone that, you know, went to college and always worked, and then you find yourself kind of in this like sidekick role where it's like you're maybe viewed as like, I don't know, oh, that's just his wife. She just goes and watches baseball games, and you kind of lose your own identity, or people just assume you don't really have anything going for you on your own. So I think that's probably the biggest struggle, is just kind of making sure you don't lose yourself in your husband's career. But I don't know, I look at it as I support him. I think he's easy to support, and, you know, especially the work through our foundation, we kind of team up on that. So, but I get that people could say that for sure.
Let's talk about the foundation. You guys do a lot of volunteer work, a lot of work with children. You volunteer with all kinds of organizations. Your husband is up for the Roberto Clemente Award this year, which goes to the player who did the most community and charity work in a season. I imagine that comes out of your work together, right? And which y'all volunteer for.
Yeah, we do a lot of it together. I think he'll say, oh, it's all Courtney, but he's there every single day, whether it's helping me respond to emails, calling sponsors for events, you know, helping me pack up auction items, raffle items, and, you know, reaching out to kids and giving them experiences and bringing veterans out to the game. It's an equal partnership in my eyes. And I think sometimes I feel bad with all he already has going on with baseball that he gives so much to the foundation, but I think it just comes natural for him, and obviously recognizing the platform that he has through baseball and using it for good just keeps him motivated.
Well, you said it yourself, right? You don't know how long his career is going to go, right? I mean, so, I mean, there's time for a lot of stuff.
Oh, definitely. Until he goes straight into coaching, which I feel like will happen because I'll have to yank him off the baseball field at some point. I just don't see him really doing anything away from the field at any point in his life, truly.
But as far as the podcast goes and what you're doing, all that, like, that's your life, right? That's what you really love doing.
Yeah, I think that helped me kind of find my own personality. And I think the best comment I got on the podcast so far was, you know, Justin got me in the room with the podcast, but then I stayed for Courtney. And I feel like that makes me feel good because so much of this is worrying, oh, you know, someone's coming into my life because they're just trying to, you know, get to Justin or be closer to Justin. So to hear that someone, you know, sees me as Courtney and enjoyed that, I think that makes me feel good.
It's an entertaining podcast. I love it. I listened to several episodes and I was like, damn.
Thank you. It's been a labor of love being my own, you know, crew and producer and promoter and host, but it's been a lot of fun.
Can I ask you what it was like to sing the national anthem in front of 52,000 people? I mean, you know, we just happened, Phil, if you wouldn't mind, we just happened to have a little copy of that. Is this awkward that we're listening to it together?
Yes, because I haven't listened to it yet.
Are you serious?
Serious.
What a great job you did.
Thank you.
You were nervous about it, right? You went and watched all the other people that bungled it, but you didn't bungle it at all. You did great.
No, I was nervous going to the stadium and kind of warming up because they have you warm up right in the press box where everyone's just kind of sitting there and you're like, oh, hi everyone, sorry, I'm just about to sing this right in front of you all. But then once I got on the field, it was really calming, and I don't know, everyone being behind you I think is helpful, and you so you can't really look at anyone or see anyone's reaction, but I don't know, there was this like overwhelming sense of calm that just came over me.
You hit it out of the park.
Thank you so much.
You sure did. Courtney Turner hosts the podcast Holding Court. That's Court with a K. She's also the wife of Justin Turner, who's playing in tonight's playoff game against the Padres. Courtney, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, a congressional race in a newly drawn district in the desert. Can a Republican who formerly opposed gay rights for decades hold on to a seat that now includes Palm Springs? That's tomorrow on Greater LA. Tell us how you're doing. Palm Springs, San Fernando Valley, Southeast LA, Orange County, wherever you are, tell us what's going on so we can better hear about LA. Maybe there's a story idea that you want to send us. KCRW.com/GLA and subscribe to the podcast too while you're there. Jenna Cagle, Juliana Mayo, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Mike Vogel, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all made the show happen today. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have a great night.